Lost and Sound is proudly sponsored by Audio Technica. Audio Technica are a global but still family-run company that make headphones, turntables, cartridges, microphones, studio quality, yet affordable products. Because they believe that high-quality audio should be accessible to all. And I'm speaking to you right now wearing their M50X headphones. They're for the studio, they're for every day. I speak to all my guests wearing these headphones. I wear them on the move because that's how I like it. But whatever way you like it, whatever way you like to listen, head on over to audiotechnica.com. to check out all of their range of stuff. Welcome to Lost and Sound. I'm Paul Hamford, I'm your host. I'm a writer and author based in Berlin, where I'm speaking to you now from. And this is the show where each episode I have conversations with the musical innovators, the outsiders, the mavericks, the artists that do their own unique thing. And we talk about music, creativity, life, and the things that inspire us to make the things that we make. Previous guests have included Peaches, Suzanne Ciani, Jim O'Rourke, Chili Gonzalez, Leticia Sadier, Ghost Poet, Nightmares on Wax, Anne Thurston, and more. And today, you're going to hear a conversation I had with British electronic musician, artist, producer, engineer, Finlay Shakespeare. Finlay is an artist that treads a fine line between, on one hand, being a music tech slash synth nerd, boffin, expert, engineer, someone that knows how to turn a bunch of wires and leads and oscillators into some sound, and on the other hand, is a romantic, widescreen, electronic pop music songwriter. He kind of combines them both. He's both boffin and poet, particularly on his current album, Illusion and Memory, which could be seen in some ways to be a homage to 80s synth pop. Each of the songs bustles with the vibe and the energy of that great period between the late 70s and early 80s, where synth pop, where studio production, where beautiful explosion of colourful melodies and personalities were infusing the pop landscape. And this is what Illusion and Memory somehow manages to capture without sounding needlessly retro. I think it's more like, rather than being a homage, it's more like an exploration of the possibilities of what happened really within a couple of years. It's like sort of, I guess, you know, Tarantino does that, doesn't he? He does that with films. He sort of imagines, what if in this period of time this happened? I'm going to expand on that. You look at something like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which I actually think is kind of quite a problematic film in a lot of ways. But in other ways, it's a very masterful film, going really into an era and digging into it and sort of saying, yeah, but what if, you know, not just with themes, but with the kind of technology available at the time. Yes. Anyway, it's rare, I think, for artists to be both boffins and poets, but that is Finlay's forte. Maybe it stems from what I know, that he had a child obsession with his parents' record collection, and this led him to creating his own music, building his own synthesizer equipment for his teenage years. And that's gone on to develop in his music. He began recording a series of monthly releases, all improvised, all captured at home using drum machines, modular synthesizers, and processed vocals by himself. And he called these House Diet. This led to being released on the acclaimed Editions Mego label. Along the way, he's collaborated with acts as diverse as Suicide, as Charlemagne Palestine, as The Grid, and Mika Levy. And now, yes, he's collaborating in a sense with me for an hour as we had this chat. We had this chat, I don't know, about a month, 6 weeks ago, something like that. Slightly different season from now, slightly more like jackety weather than right now as I'm speaking to you. Full 30 degrees Berlin summer. I hope wherever you are, it's fucking beautiful as well. And I hope you enjoyed this interview.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you now. Yes.
Yes. Yes. Yes, there we go. That's it. Yeah.
How are you doing?
I'm really good, thank you. Yeah. How are you doing?
Yeah, not too bad. Not too bad. It's been a bit of a mad week, but yeah, slowly kind of settling down now. So yeah.
Excellent. Is that to do with the release?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, everything's seemingly come at once, really. Mm. So I was putting a show on here in Bristol, middle of the week. Day after, I just got noticed that the studio space that I have to kind of record and everything is set to be completely stripped out, and sounds like it might be a demolition job. So we've all got to leave within 2 months.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's all a bit crazy at the minute, but yeah, kind of slowly starting to figure a action plan out, I guess.
Oh, that's good. That's good, isn't it? This is so funny. Like the, I mean, you know, I think particularly when you have like a release coming up or a big thing, mm-hmm. and then you sort of put a lot of focus into that, then suddenly there's this like external stuff that you don't know about that just kind of comes in there.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's always the way. It's kind of like, it's never just one thing that comes out of thin air. It's always, you know, about five. So
yeah, like yeah. Buses, you know. Do you think you're better at dealing with that now than say when you were like starting out making music?
I don't know. I think it's just progressively gotten like more intense. That's always kind of been the way that it's happened. I've said yes to too many things, pretty much, especially this year. I'm trying to like find the way of saying no in kind of the most respectful way I possibly can, because it usually just gets like, you know, you try and say no and then your arm gets twisted and you kind of think, oh, okay, yeah, sure, whatever. And then you regret it, you know, a couple of months in.
Yeah. I always have the thing, if I look at my calendar in advance and I'll say, you know, like I sort of sometimes say yes to things if I see I've got space in the calendar. Mm-hmm. But then like, it's also like the kind of space that you don't put in the calendar that you need to have the things in. It's like, oh my Absolutely. God, yeah, that is just insane. I've got to go from this to that.
It's always the way, always the way.
And does your sort of, because, you know, it's the third solo album under your name, but also like, you know, you've released quite a lot of albums now. Does the process of releasing, does that kind of become more familiar to you, or is there always something changes with that?
I think this last release has been particularly, I don't know, kind of bittersweet really, because it was actually finished about 2 years ago. It got delivered to Peter at Editions Mago. And then about 3 or 4 weeks later, he passed away. So it's been through this whole process of kind of, and I mean, even back then I was saying to Peter, like, well, let's not do, you know, vinyl because CD is so quick and we can just get it out. So even the kind of like vinyl process now is just taking so much longer than it has in the past. So I don't know. I think for each of the three albums, it's been quite strange because the first one, it was the first release and, you know, I'd never really done anything like that before. The second one pretty much landed just as soon as kind of all of Europe went into lockdown.
Yeah.
So I know, again, Peter at Mago was kind of a bit stressed out because he just thought like, all of my supply chain is going to fold here. And then about 2 weeks later, he was like, no, everything's great because everyone's stuck at home buying records. So, and then, yeah, this third one has just been, yeah, really kind of bittersweet because of Peter's passing and then finding Luke at Alter. And yeah, just, you know, it's the standard kind of thing of like, you end up in a new circle of people, some of who you already know and, yeah, kind of getting to grips with like how that community works and then, yeah, going from there, really.
Yeah, and then I guess like the emotional content of the music as well, you know, without wanting to sound sort of glib or anything, like the title Illusion and Memory as well, did that sort of feel like it took on an extra bit of meaning for you?
Yeah, I mean, a little bit. It's kind of, Yeah, it's a bit of a strange one because, again, I was talking to someone else about this. Like a lot of the lyrics, I don't really necessarily know what the meaning is until quite a long time afterwards, where I'm almost trying to like analyze it myself. It's almost a kind of therapy in a way because, well, the way that I write lyrically is just almost complete improvisation. So I'll leave, you know, the track running. I'll just do take after take and then almost do a bit of a kind of cut up method with what's there and try and figure out what at least sounds good. And then you're left with this thing where I'm, you know, just like, I've got no idea what this really means. There's a couple of tracks on the album that are kind of written out, but that one, you know, the I Saw You is particularly just like, I've got no idea what this is really about. Apart from, I know the first few lines I stole from a Peter Tchaikovsky film, but I think that's it. So yeah, I don't know.
So interesting though, isn't it? Because I think, I mean, when I was making music, I used to write lyrics like that. And then I read that David Byrne does that approach as well. And then I'm reading at the moment that Rick Rubin book on the creative act. And he's sort of talking about how many people he works with where they kind of approach that. But it's so weird how, I don't know, just you sort of finding a shape with what sort of, you know, it's like your voice is just an instrument really, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, I mean, for me, that feels like the most suitable kind of method because I would never class myself as a singer. You know, I never kind of went into this thinking like I will be a singer kind of thing. But it's something that I've wanted to explore and try. And, you know, most of the other instrumentation on the album comes from kind of, you know, not outright experimentation, but playing around with things and kind of improvisation and then falling into a certain thing where you think, okay, well, I can write something from this, you know, and it grows from there. So if I'm doing that with like the synthesizers and the drum machines and all the stuff in the studio, why shouldn't I do it with the vocals as well? Why shouldn't I do it lyrically? So that's kind of my outlook on it. I'd love to see, you know, the kind of other, you know, greats that I know that work to that kind of model. I'd love to know what the source of that was for them. So people like David Byrne, you know, was he coming at it from a lack of creative ideas, was it a strategy to kind of, you know, get lyrics done, you know, kind of thing? I don't know.
Yeah. Do you think this has something to do with intuition as well?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's, you know, a lot of that music is about feel, isn't it? You know, again, that kind of makes sense that if you're, you know, tracking constantly and kind of getting these bits of lyrics down that are purely, I don't know, pulled from some kind of ether somewhere and based on that feel vibe thing, then it makes sense. Yeah. It's interesting because you kind of wonder like, well, what would happen if you started writing like really terrible, soppy ballads in that way? You know, could you imagine, I don't know, just some of that stuff from like the late 90s. I was thinking about this like the other day, how there was a certain proliferation of like real corny ballads around that time. And that seeming, I can't remember like the last big ballad that really came out. I don't know if it would be like Adele or someone like that.
Yeah. But it's interesting. Yeah. I've had a couple of conversations about this actually. And I don't know, even going back to the early 90s on these kind of ballads, but like, you know, in my mind, you know, I think of things like sort of everything from, I mean, this is a pretty good quality song, but Stay by Shakespeare's Sister, you know, sound effect. But, you know, with the kind of videos with the sort of, you know, the kind of all filmed in castles with doves flying around. and
yeah, the kind of melodrama is amazing, isn't it? Just the,
definitely.
You know, and like, you imagine that in whatever kind of damp, you know, grotty studio it got recorded in.
I know, totally. And I think, you know, and I don't know, it's weird. I think that's something that's definitely, we've become a bit too sort of ironic about now. You know, I don't know, some point, like, you know, irony gets everything at some point or other, doesn't it? And sort of shuts it down a little bit. I know what you mean. Like, if you were going to sort of, if your automatic process or your intuitive process for writing lyrics did come out out with like a sort of like Bryan Adams epic ballad. would you just go for it and say, okay, that's me, you
know? I don't think I could do it. I had a couple of people say about this new stuff that it's like, oh, it's a lot more kind of, you know, singer-songwriter-y. And again, I don't know where that comes from. It wasn't a conscious decision. I don't know if it was just listening to the Blue Nile a lot. I think it's probably that, if anything. But it's interesting because I think that there's certainly things that I do. I mean, even some of the material that I'm working on now, you know, you kind of make a... I guess almost like a demo version, right? And you sit with that for a while. And from like the moment of creation of it, you think, God, this is the best thing I've ever done. I can't believe that I've managed to achieve this. And then a few months go by and you're immediately like, right, I can completely pick all of this apart. This is not what I want to do, but like some of the material that's there, I want to, you know, rearrange or rewrite or whatever. And it's that whole iterative thing, I think. I mean, that's the thing. I think if I was to, you know, if some kind of soppy ballad was to come out of what I'm doing, it would just immediately get redone almost as something else. But it's all iterative. It's all this like big, iterative process. And I kind of see the releases as that a little bit as well, because it's not, I'm yet to go to kind of, you know, making an album and saying, well, this is going to have a concept or whatever, or an underlying thing. And I don't really know what's coming next, but it's, I guess that's the joy of it. You know, you keep changing your kind of creative process in little ways. And even the smallest change can lead to quite a big, like, dramatic change in the end results.
When I listen to your music as well, and like, you know, all of your releases, really, I sort of feel like there's this really interesting balance between the tech and the sort of the romantic artistry, you know, and I think it's quite interesting because, you know, you've had quite a lot of sort of tech experience of being an engineer at the Moog Sound Lab, but then there's also the, you know, we're talking just now about the kind of intuitive woo-woo almost of music as well, you know, you know, I think it's quite unusual for someone to sort of be able to do both, be like very expressive and free with their music and also be quite rigidly understand the engineering. You know, what is that kind of balance for you like? Does it feel very straightforward to you?
Well, I mean, thank you, first of all. I think for me, it's again, I've been thinking about this quite recently. I think I'm just really interested in like the synthesis of things, you know, outside of sound synthesis, just bringing different things together and seeing kind of what fits. And for what I've done over these last few albums, you know, it is kind of like taking an interest in, you know, sound engineering and the technicalities of sound and electronics. And then also just, you know, a lot of the music that essentially I grew up with and that I listen to a lot still. And yeah, it's kind of a weird thing because I would never approach the two things with having said that, I over the last few albums I haven't really approached it from a kind of like, you know, well, I'm going to write a song but I'm going to do it with a very technical mindset, whereas the stuff that I'm working on at the moment, I am actually setting very rigid rules and kind of disciplines for at least how I approach the instrumental aspect of it, the actual like synthesis of each sound and trying to avoid particular cliches simply because I feel that I've kind of overdone them now, you know.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, it's like, that's finished. I can leave that. And now I need to kind of push myself into doing something new. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, like up until now, it hasn't really been a conscious thing. I guess the most conscious that kind of thing has become is going into the studio, having built like a new piece of equipment or whatever. And I mean, that was what at least the first phase of lockdown was amazing for that, because I like had a little soldering station at home, mainly to do the day job, but then also, you know, if I ran out of stuff to do, I brought a load of these old synth kits home that I just hadn't touched in years. And being able to actually finish a lot of these kind of instruments and then say, well, when, you know, when we're allowed back out, I'll take all that down to the studio and then it's going to be great, you know. And there's definitely a lot on the kind of new album that is pulled from that, you know, plugging something in for the first time and going, okay, well, this is what I've got from this. Let's track that. And then that becomes some, you know, I don't know, the baseline of this particular track that gets written, you know, on top of it. So, yeah, it's kind of never really, it's never really consciously hit me, anything like that. But it's, I mean, it's, yeah, it's a huge compliment. Thank you so much for saying, because, yeah.
No worries.
It kind of validates what I'm doing.
Oh, that's nice to know. That's nice to know. Yeah. It is really interesting what you're saying about this kind of process and the balance between it, or if it's just natural. And you're saying that with what you're working on next is like starting to put rules in of things that have, you feel like you've become familiar with in your work. Does it feel like sort of to begin off with, you get a bit of a hall pass where you can kind of just throw stuff at the wall, or like you could just like, you can start to see how things grow when you just let them happen?
So I think it's, at least with the new stuff, it's almost avoiding any of that. It's kind of saying like, just approaching you know, the studio with a very, very clear idea of, okay, I'm so like what I'm trying to avoid is essentially any kind of like, and this sounds incredibly pretentious, but any kind of metaphor within the actual sound itself.
Okay, so yeah.
This is getting, it's quite arty farty, but like, say if you have reverb, if even the act of like applying reverb to a mix, you immediately place that sound within like an artificial room, right? That's a metaphor, get rid of it. So it's that kind of thing. And like saying, even down to like how a bass part would sound. Okay, well, I don't want a synthesized sound that sounds like a bass guitar or an upright bass or, you know, something. So then you're left with like a very almost like small pool of initial ideas, but then you can take those wherever, you know, they may go. So that's kind of been what I've been working on recently. And that has, it's been really good because it's pushed me into doing things that I definitely wouldn't have done naturally, you know?
Yeah.
And it's restricted me from going kind of like, okay, let's just track everything and then kind of pull back. It's a very different process, but it's taking a long time. It's just like the longest, you know, and again, it's kind of working iteratively. I'm getting to the, you know, most iterations of tracks that I have before, but yet they're still kind of nowhere near finished, which is slightly uncomfortable because I don't know when they're going to be finished.
Yeah.
You know, and again, going back to the whole kind of like pretentious arty farty thing, it really does feel a little bit like you can't see it till it's finished, kind
of
thing.
Yeah, you know?
And yeah, but it's kind of pushing me to think in different ways. And I think I needed that because even just like I can tell you now how I would have approached like, I don't know, a bass sound before and how I would approach it now with this newer material, and that I just needed to stop, you know, that whole like bow sound is really nice, but there's only so much bow that the world needs, you know, kind of thing.
But, yeah. Like I just imagine a cover version of what the world needs now is bow.
Bow. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But so I don't know if that answers the question really.
It's all about the flow. It's all about the flow really, isn't it? Yeah, I think for me, it's about trying to push in habits or sort of change habits through, you know, because I know that like I do my best stuff, or at least I think I do, when I can just think freely. But I also know that in thinking freely, I can kind of go to really like lazy habits, you know, so it's almost like I have to kind of like discipline manager Paul has to set stuff up so that idiot child Paul can just go in and have fun, you know.
I think it's definitely, that's exactly the sentiment that I'm kind of, you know, going with at the moment, is it's just, it is kind of laziness really, when you just think like, well, that's a tried and tested thing and I know it works and that's what I'm going to use. And it's making work that you don't feel necessarily comfortable. It's that old like Bowie adage, right? Where, you know you're doing something right if you feel slightly uncomfortable doing it. And, I'm not necessarily saying that immediately makes something good, but it's certainly something that you can actually learn from and take more away from than simply just kind of, using tried and tested methods, which I think, getting on a bit of a soapbox, I think that is kind of what's wrong with a lot of, at least kind of like the charting pop music is that you look at the top 10 and a lot of tracks will be almost like remodels of, one thing that came out maybe a year or two ago that did actually change the paradigm a little bit. But now because people have cottoned on that, that sound is hot, then everyone wants to get a piece of that kind of thing, and it sucks because there's just nothing sounds interesting or fresh or different anymore. There'll be one thing maybe every couple of years where you go like, oh, okay, that's weird. And then it just gets copied and overplayed to the point where it's not interesting anymore. It's completely boring.
Do you think like with that as well, that the sort of algorithms and quantizing and things that kind of, I think, to me feel like they play a part in that as well. Like, particularly people making music electronically, it's so, it's so easy to just kind of set stuff up, how a DAW is set up, where a lot of music around has been done like that.
I don't know, because it's like, a good friend of mine, he uses the phrase option paralysis. And that is kind of what like a DAW presents to you, because you have everything. You have absolutely everything. And I mean, I really try, like the way I use, I record to Ableton, and the way that I use live is that it's essentially like a glorified tape machine and a cutting block, it's very much that and a bit of a mixing desk and a like routing matrix. That's kind of it. I don't really use it for writing, and I don't really use it for, the whole column, is it session view or whatever? I barely ever touch it. And I think it's simply because like, I can't work like that. I've tried it and everything that I've ever done with it is not very good, at least in my eyes. But then also I think it does breed this whole like, you're trying to find a sound, and it can be incredibly hard to find that sound in that kind of in that environment, in that situation, because you don't really know where to start. There isn't it's such a blank canvas, even more blank than just having a few machines and you just run them, against one another, because then at least you know that you have these three things in front of you and that's it. Whereas like, I don't think the whole kind of, one new sound coming along and then that being copied for 2-3 years. I don't necessarily think technology is to blame for that, but I think it might be a mindset of like, well, how did they get that sound? And then because all of these tools are so easy to just get now, it just becomes the kind of status quo, whereas Tony Visconti's like drum sound on low, going back to Bowie again, to get that like Eventide harmonizer thing, you had to get the Eventide harmonizer, and there's only so many Eventide harmonizers that Eventide can make at the time, blah, 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 blah. Whereas now it's like, if that was to happen now, I mean, I say this, I'm pretty sure he's even done it, with some probably collaboration with Eventide. You just download the plugin, you load it up and it's there and blah, 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 blah. And, in terms of, financial costs, I don't know if it's probably a lot less now, but just the immediate like availability of everything, I think is slightly... not dangerous, but it kind of like facilitates this laziness, right?
Yeah.
The thing with, and again, I don't want this to sound kind of self-inflatory or anything like that, but if you're building your own equipment, it takes time to do that, and it takes time to like figure out all this stuff. And then if that's what you're going to use primarily, then you not only have you kind of made your own sound, but you've actually built it. It's there in the nuts and bolts of the thing. So I think that's kind of, yeah, how I look at all of that is that I just try and avoid, making things easy for myself.
Yeah.
you know, that's my mindset at the minute, you know, just don't fall into anything that's too relaxed and too, you know, because where do you push that? It's hard to push it. So I don't know.
I think in a lot of, to me, I sometimes get the impression that being able to, like as you say, find a sound really easily without the back process, whether that's like in terms of like only a few effects units in the world having that, or sort of something to do with like the songwriting process. And I don't want to sound either like, you know, like a fuddy-duddy in this, because I do sort of like feel like innovation comes from quite often people messing around with whatever means they've got, you know. But I feel that there's something sometimes, if something's instantly available, it's a bit like just with apps generally. Like if you can order food generally, you stop to give a shit about the process of where it comes from, or like the fact that like some delivery driver has probably paid below minimal wage, you know, without a union to get it to you, you know. And I think that kind of feeds into the kind of creativity as well. Like maybe the music sounds soulless that are the copies of this one good song, because people are just doing it instantly and they're not sort of building their own backstory into their own character into sort of their struggle to make it, you know?
Yeah, I think that's completely right. And I think this is the thing, like it is hard to break out of that. You know, the technology now has made, it has just made things easy. I mean, and I don't even necessarily think like computers are to blame, because you look at kind of how computer music was in like the mid 90s, the late 90s, the early 2000s, particularly with the whole like laptop thing. And all of that is so radically different. And because like the tools were very just strange, you know, I remember kind of like learning how to use like Cubase and stuff, you know, in my teens. And it was really, even that felt a lot weirder than it does today, you know? It feels like all I ever wanted to do with that. And I don't know if it was because, you know, I'm just growing up with this stuff and it's, oh yeah, what can I do with it? But I always like had, how can I edit this? And what can I do with, you know, like reversing things and then processing it and then reversing it again and all of that stuff. And I don't really do so much of that now. Again, that's maybe another thing to consider. It's like, do you settle into these processes in time? I mean, I guess you do, you know, you always think like, well, you know, and finding even that your own, how you kind of like critique your own process can end up actually kind of stifling you a little bit. So like a friend of mine, he was saying like, oh, don't ever reverse anything, because it sounds really cliched, you know. It's like, it totally can. And it totally can sound like a Beatles pastiche or whatever. But some of the time it doesn't. Some of the times, it gives you something that's like really interesting and you think, oh, okay, yeah, I'll use that, you know. So yeah, it's just so many variables in all this stuff, you know.
Totally. Yeah, as soon as you decide on one thing, it's like there's a contrary point as well. I really related to what you're saying about your friends saying not to reverse anything. Like when I was making music, I had like a couple of friends that I'd always play works in progress to, and one of them would just really piss me off, and because I couldn't really understand why at the time, but it would always be because he would say, Yeah, there's definitely a dubs, there's a dub thing you've got with that bass going on there. And then you go, you want to make it a little bit more dub, you know, or just something like that. And it was just like, trying to sort of describe it in a way. And I think he was just genuinely trying to have a conversation about what poor guy I was just subjecting him. And he probably didn't even want me to play him these sort of half-assed demos I was making. But, you know, it sort of somehow had an effect on me, you know, as well.
it can be really tricky because I think, you know, talking about music is really difficult because music itself, I think, is like, in my mind, it's the most abstract form of art that exists because it has no real physical manifestation, right?
Mm.
You know, you can have recordings and you can have physical media, but that's not what the music actually is. That's just an artifact of the process. So kind of talk about recording and talk about the writing process, that can get even more abstract because you're suddenly trying to kind of put into words something that you can't really express in any other way than the music itself. And then, you know, you go and, I mean, even when I listen to music, I'm always kind of like, well, where's this come from? Like, is there a meaning behind this? Or is it kind of, you know, and there's nothing wrong in this. Is it the art for art's sake thing? You know, what was the intention? Was there an intention? Is it all completely accidental? I mean, I love that. I love that about music. I love kind of, I'm a real anorak in terms of, you know, the, like, I guess, process element. I'm like, where was this recorded? What did they record it on? You know, what was the temperature in the room kind of thing? And all of those, you know, questions that absolutely, well, probably a handful of people would ask, but that have absolutely no bearing on the music whatsoever and can be completely throwaway. But, you know, once you get in that mindset of like, I want to know, you just want to know everything, you know, you essentially want to be in attendance to all the sessions. And then you realize that half the time spent recording the thing is just, you know, achingly terrible and so uncomfortable and just like the studios genuinely I think they're horrible places so much of the time. I'm really lucky that I think most of my experiences have been really positive, but I've had a couple of experiences in kind of like far more traditional studios where you just go like, Christ, people have to do this as a day job and it's fucking terrible. It's like it's pulling nails to the extreme. And like, you know, the big producer in chief, you cannot suggest a single thing because he's the big producer in chief. You know, and why have we been sat here for 5 hours listening to you try and put a kick drum pattern down, kind of thing, you know.
Oh my God. Yeah. I mean, obviously without naming names or anything like that, you know, I mean, can you think of any sort of particular examples of that where you've just sort of felt, I mean,
immediately there is that. I was in a session for a few days. And it was really bad because like they in the room there were some amazing players, like top class players, and I was there pretty much on an engineering role. It was just so bad because the band would do a take and then the producer would essentially say, okay, well, let's strip that back. And so he'd take the drums out and then try and reprogram the drums on like a drum machine. But you've got like this top class drummer there. So why on earth would you replace that with anything else? And just kind of essentially reconstructing this like top tier band with a load of really cheap like plugins. And I was just sat there, and by the end of it, I was like, this is another world, man. This is fucking crazy. Because, you know, this is their time. I presume they're getting paid for this. And yet, you know, it's just like, well, hang on, give me 6 hours and I might be able to make it like a snare line. It's unbelievable. It was genuinely crazy. And I'm not sure if that project ever saw the light of day. I don't think it ever came out because you know, and the songs were really good. Like the songwriter that had come in to kind of work with this group, she's really fantastic. And she's doing like quite, well, big things now, at least in terms of performance. And you just think this was such a waste because you had this amazing talent in the room and it all got literally muted just on the desk. Just mute that. Crazy. Absolutely crazy.
this sounds a bit like, I don't know. I mean, I kind of had this picture when you were saying that of like, you know, this sort of Trevor Horn method. It's like someone trying to do the Trevor Horn method of like, I remember like hearing about the sort of process of Frankie Goes to Hollywood and the sort of continued reconstruction of that. You know, that's obviously like sort of, that probably a lot of pain involved in that, but they got amazing result at the end of it. And there was a process, but I think sometimes people just kind of emulate like something someone did once, you know.
And I think it, like, again, going back to process with the like Frankie stuff, that suits the music as well. That really suits that music. I'm not a huge fan of that stuff, but it is very, you know, at the very least Trevor Horn could clearly see that, whereas as this session it was just like, this is not suitable. And this is totally like the process and the art are just so far apart that they really should be kept, you know, at the two ends of the room.
And yeah,
sure. You know, supplement, you know, the live kit with a few drum synthy bits or whatever, but to just replace, to just totally strike out. I really was baffled because it was akin to, I don't know, you know, having, I don't know, Scott Walker in the room and saying like, well, we're gonna replace Scott Walker with like Microsoft Sam or something, you know. Yeah. Just think, what the fuck is going on?
Yeah,
I don't know. I now want to hear like all the Walker Brothers hits redone with Microsoft Sam, because that would be absolutely atrocious.
Well, I mean, I think that's something you could probably do now with AI, isn't it?
I mean, to be fair, we did at work, we've wasted a lot of time really. There's this amazing tool from Adobe that is designed, funnily enough, for podcasters. You can put audio in and it's supposed to clear it up and do magical things to it. And what it's essentially trying to do is pull, you know, speech vocals, for want of a better word, out of like your audio file and kind of do a little bit of almost resynthesis with it.
Okay.
But it becomes absolutely hilarious if you put in like full stereo tracks, you know, and particularly anything where the instrumentation already sounds a little bit vocal. So like we put Living on a Prayer by Bon Jovi in, you know, it's got the do-wa-do-wa-do-do-do.
Yeah.
So you get this kind of like choir of you know, artificially generated voices all just going, yeah. It's amazing. You know, we just keep thinking like, wait, no, we've got to enhance that one. And you run it through like a few times. If you keep kind of, again, doing iterations with it, it becomes more and more completely just twisted and garbled. It's hilarious.
That sounds funny. I'd love to run, love to check that out and run maybe like the frog chorus through that.
Yeah, no, honestly, stuff like that, it's amazing because you know.
Totally. And I wanted to ask you a little bit about the kind of influences in Illusion and Memory as well, because it still feels like there's, you know, the 80s, the late 70s, 80s electronic pop is very hard on the sleeve, and, you know, it never feels throwback, you know, it feels like I don't know if it's like the title has got something to do with Illusion and Memory, like in the way we process sort of, you know, sounds from our past can become like musical notes in a way.
I mean, to me, it's just, I think, again, this ties in with that kind of like technical aspect versus the creative, like artist aspect of it. I look at that time and I think it's insane that say from, let's say 78 to 84. I don't think there has been such a rapid shift in the technology available to not even necessarily studios, but kind of bands that, yeah, okay, maybe they have a little bit of money, but you know, they're not necessarily rolling in it. It's such a sweeping change. And I mean, you look at things like, I don't know, take Cabaret Voltaire. So go from like Nag 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 to, you know, Drinking Gasoline and all that stuff. That's such a marked shift in sound. And a lot of it is to do with the technological change that's happening around them. So the thing that I'm quite interested in is kind of saying, well, hang on, if that happens so quickly, there must be kind of processes and elements to that you know, set of technologies that were essentially not abandoned, but not discovered. And, you know, I'm certainly not saying that I've done it in any way, shape or form, but I think it's interesting to kind of go back to that mentality and to use some of the same kind of instruments or some of the same circuits and stuff like that and say like, okay, well, what can you actually get out of this that those guys didn't necessarily, because they simply didn't actually have the time because, you know, they're being rushed off their feet with, like, you know, as soon as they've got the one synthesizer, then a year later, something else has come along where it's, I don't know, got patch memory. And then suddenly it's polyphonic. And then suddenly, oh, it's not analog at all. It's all digital and FM. Oh, sampling's come along. Okay. Well, now we've got, you know, it's remarkable. And I'm not sure, I guess, like, the advent of computing has done that and laptop technology, but I can't think of really any other time where, at least in music, I guess maybe like multi-track recording.
Yeah.
You know, it's such a quantum leap in everything. I mean, I always think of the, like, whole BEF thing where it's like Martin Ware, Ian Craig Marsh do Being Boiled. And then a few years later, they're producing Tina Turner. That's nuts.
Isn't it?
You know, that time frame is insane. And I'm not sure if we'll ever necessarily see that again, especially now where we are kind of at the limits of, like, silicon technology. This is the thing. You're now like, okay, well, quantum computing is the next thing. And I don't really know. I guess that's an exciting thing. I don't know where that fits into audio and to music. You know, there must be
applications. That could open something up. That could open up like kind of a new rapid acceleration then.
Yeah, but it's a very specific form of computing that I'm not sure has a use. I'm sure it does. I just can't think of one because I don't have the imagination to think of that. You know, and again, it kind of even goes back to things like, you know, some of the kind of avant-garde tape music and JRM and all of that stuff, where you listen to it and it's incredible, simply because how on earth did these people imagine that in the first place, let alone actually have the gumption and the commitment to say, okay, I'm going to put that down to tape and I'm going to make all these edits and I'm going to, you know, run all these processes through that are incredibly laborious and time consuming. Because, yeah, okay, we have technology now that speeds all of that up by, you know, again, this massive, massive, massive leap. But I don't hear anything as exciting necessarily as, like, Parmigiani, apart from a few people. You know, they're very select people that I think are really doing anything as exciting as that. And again, is it because the imagination is just kind of like, it's almost overwhelmed with the number of tools we have now?
Yeah. It's just that I'm reading recently in the Cozy Funny Tutti book about Delia Derbyshire's processes at the BBC and, like, her kind of working at night, kind of like laying down corridors full of tape loops and stuff like that. And then also having all of the opposition against her at the time to kind of do this kind of stuff. Yeah. It sort of feels like that is really, really, really pushing, you know, just pushing it on multiple levels, really, you know, creative, just sort of socially, just actually just sort of finding the hours of the day where she could actually do this stuff without probably some guy saying, what are you doing here?
Yeah. I mean, I think, again, it's kind of like, I'm sure there are things in all of that world that are still yet to be discovered. There's an incredible artist called Jerome Nottinger.
I don't know. I will check out.
Yeah, I'll send you a link to his stuff. Cool. I mean, we put him on here in town like a few days ago, and I'd seen him once before. He just plays with a Revox B77, a tape loop, and that's it. And he's kind of essentially using the Revox as an instrument. So he has, like, a couple of contact mics that some of the time, like, he's playing the actual tape machine with the contact mics. Sometimes he's passing things over it. And he'll play for, you know, half an hour, and at no point does it become, you know, a drag or dull. It's always kind of like your jaws wide open and you're just like, this is incredible, because I'm seeing this happen in real time. And yet speaking to him, he's been doing this for the best part of, well, he's I think he said he got his tape machine in 87, 86, 87. So he's been working with this same machine since then. And he said he's still finding new things. And again, it's just like, how do you, you know, if how long is that? 35 years, 40
years? Yeah. Yeah. Coming up for 40 years. Yeah. 37, you know, but yeah.
If you have that amount of time dedicated to this one medium and this one, not one process, but one kind of, you know, way of looking at it, and you're still finding new things, then surely that means that there's absolutely, you know, vaults worth of stuff in that technology that has yet to be unlocked. And again, that's kind of what I'm interested in with all of that, you know, all of that stuff that I kind of grew up listening to, is that really the kind of like heyday of it, the paragon of it, really only lasted maybe 3 years in my opinion, you know.
Yeah, and it's, yeah, I see what you mean. That's a really, really interesting perspective, actually. And so, and kind of, I think that kind of also echoes into what, you know, we've been talking of, like, various points today about, like, having restraints and allowing you to kind of explore further within that. And like, and the opposite of like, how unlimited everything can kind of create stale patterns and kind of copycat patterns and stuff like that. So it's almost like there's, like you said, there's a period of 80s music that because it was always in fluxus, it was always moving on, was never, you know, there's like sort of, maybe if we got stuck in a Groundhog Day, there would just be this kind of wealth of 80s music that really, really explored further and deeper and deeper into it.
Yeah, and I genuinely think, I mean, you listen to stuff like, okay, it's a little less commercial, but things like Severed Heads, like what Tom Ellard was doing, again, with very like rudimentary digital technology, but also, in fact, using tape as well, and what Gary Bradbury did with him as well. And that alone is that sound is so striking and it's so fresh. And you just think like, well, hang on, you know, this is 40 years old now. And yet you could put that on and you couldn't date it. You know, there's no aspect of it that comes across as kind of, you know, having aged badly. So if that's the case, like, is it, you know, can one get back to that and explore that in more detail? Because again, you kind of ask a lot of those guys, like, would you ever go back and kind of do it that way? And they're all like, fuck no, it was terrible. And it's like, you know, like, well, yeah, I mean, you know, you might say that now, but it's still, well, at least for people who like, you know, messing about with gear, it's fun. Like, it's just fun having, you know, dials and switches and all that stuff. It's just fun. It's more fun than sitting at a, you know, computer screen and doing
Okay, so that was me, Paul Hamford, chatting with Finlay Shakespeare for Lost and Sound podcast. And we had that chat, I don't know, about 6 weeks ago or so. Thank you so much, Finlay, for your words. Really, really, really enjoyed that chat there. Illusion of Memory is released on Alta Records. It's out now on Alta Records. And Lost and Sound is proudly sponsored by Audio Technica. Audio Technica are a global but still family-run company that make headphones, turntables, cartridges, microphones, studio quality, yet affordable products, because they believe that high quality audio should be accessible to all. And thanks to ESO for doing the music you hear at the beginning at the end of every episode of Lost and Sound. My book, Coming to Berlin, is available in all good bookshops and via Velocity Press's website. I hope you're having a beautiful day, and I'll chat to you soon.